Everyone, you're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. An auspicious occasion we're marking tonight. Not sure if it's mentioned on your calendar, but it should be. Today is Alien Abduction Day, ET Abduction Day. No particular significance to this date in UFO lore, none that I can find anyway. The date was chosen by a Canadian UFO conference back in 2008. So thanks, Canadians. We hoist a Molson's in your direction. Folks, give your sweetie a kiss in honor of the occasion. Try not to get abducted tonight, at least not for the next 4 hours, because you'll want to stick around for this. This week also marks another auspicious occasion. It is the 50th anniversary of swamp gas, give or take a day or two. Swamp gas, the ultimate excuse for a UFO wave. An infamous term coined by the late, great Dr. J. Allen Hynek, father of modern ufology, back during the days when he was sort of the explainer-in-chief for the Air Force Project Blue Book. After there was this huge UFO flap in Michigan, all kinds of witnesses, Dr. Hynek tossed out that lame explanation. It wasn't flying saucers. It might have been swamp gas. And he never quite lived it down. Though, as you probably know, Dr. Hynek by then had grown weary of explaining away legitimate reports of UFOs, and he more than made up for his transgressions by devoting the rest of his life to legitimizing the study of UFOs. 50 years ago, 1966 was one heck of a year for UFOs. It's been called the year of UFOs by some writers. A huge flap in the United States, all around the world. In Australia, there was something called the Westall incident. Flying saucer landed near a school and was witnessed by about 200 people. I think that case is going to get a lot of attention when the anniversary rolls around in a couple of weeks. But there were sightings everywhere in 66, including by U.S. astronauts, a lot of very credible witnesses. So we're marking the occasion tonight with a UFO-palooza, including a fresh look at the granddaddy of all UFO cover-up cases, Roswell. Now, you're thinking to yourself, how can there possibly be anything new with Roswell? I mean, by now, aren't all the witnesses dead? Haven't they picked the bones clean on that one? And the answer is a resounding no. Among the cadre of hardcore, deeply devoted Roswell researchers, no one has burned up more shoe leather, done more firsthand interviews, chased down more leads and clues than our guest tonight. Don Schmidt and Tom Carey have written 4 books on Roswell. They've collaborated with the other biggies in this very specialized field, including Kevin Randall and Stan Friedman. The lengths to which they have gone to run down every tiny fact, every possible witness, is astonishing. And tonight, we'll hear the Roswell story anew from a fresh angle, a very human angle. If, as the Air Force has told us time and again, in several different ever-changing versions of the story, that this thing that crashed at Roswell or near Roswell wasn't a flying saucer. Oh, Lordy, no. It was a weather balloon, or it was a secret weather balloon, or it was a really, really double-secret probation weather balloon. Plus, they threw in some crash test dummies and dropped them in the desert to kind of look like alien bodies. If that's all it was, then why would so many people have been threatened, told that if they ever say a word, if they ever tell anything about what they saw, they'd be killed. Their families would be killed. Why did the military visit so many families and tear up their homes looking for little pieces of wreckage? Why did this intimidation continue for decades? Why were phones tapped and media silenced? Why are the stories told by dozens and dozens of people so similar, so consistent, so chilling? Tonight we hear the story as told directly by the people who lived it, the children of Roswell. That's the title of the new book. Family members and loved ones of the Roswell witnesses who say that even now, they are reluctant to spill all of the beans. They're looking over their shoulder, wondering who's listening in. Don Schmidt and Tom Carey will join me an hour from now. Should be good stuff. The book is certainly excellent. But first, we've got another distinguished guest, a pioneer, not only in the UFO field, but in the larger investigation of weird stuff. Call it paranormal. Strange beings, demons, aliens, creatures, poltergeists, hauntings. Put it all together, and you've got what almost looks like a unified theory of high strangeness. Brad Steiger has been chasing this stuff for 50 years, and not many people in the world can say that. He's written something like 170 books, staggering to think about it. With his wife, Sherry, he's traveled the world investigating mysteries, interviewing witnesses. His new book is an almost encyclopedic compendium of the weird and wonderful, the strange and frightening. It's called Voices from Beyond, Real Visitors and Parallel Dimensions. And it's maybe the Steiger's best work, which is saying a lot. I mentioned about Alan Hynek and the swamp gas story, and this being the 50th anniversary. The Steigers knew and worked with Dr. Hynek, so I think that might be where we start the conversation tonight. Brad Steiger joins me in a few minutes, and it should be a lot of fun. Our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, helped me put together our usual eclectic collection of odds and ends culled from media around the world. We call it Naps News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Among the stories of interest tonight, what if aliens really did reach out and contact Earth? I suppose in a way that could not be covered up. Some speculation on how we humans would react. We might think we're ready. I'm not so sure. Also posted tonight, intriguing speculation piece about why they dropped the A-bombs on Japan. Was there something else going on behind the scenes? Other than trying to end the war or trying to scare the Russians, was someone else pulling the strings? Some really interesting quotes from a couple of former presidents that I had not read before. Also got a story about a company that says it wants to try to clone your dead loved ones. Good grief. Oh, and a story I just love. It's about the Maltese Falcon, the prop used in the movie. Perhaps the most iconic and valuable movie prop of all time, right up there with the ruby slippers. The story of what happened to the Black Bird is a mystery worthy of Sam Spade. Terrific piece from Vanity Fair for you to read, but don't read it right now. It's a long story, so because we've got things that are going to deserve your full attention, so read it later. But while you're on the Coast website checking out Naps News, stop by and click on the section that tells you how to become a Coast Insider. I think the cost is something like $7 a month. So if you listen all the time, that's a good deal. You can access a vast archive of previous shows, listen to them more than once on any device at any time of the day or night. It's a cool gift idea for loved ones, you know, a way to celebrate Alien Abduction Day if you want. People who, like you, are into this kind of stuff. And you can also find out how to subscribe to George Norrie's television show, a video version of Coast to Coast. And with that, let's get right to it. We have so much to cover tonight. So by all means, call for the dog, fluff up the pillow for the cat, turn down the lights, pour a cup of Joe, slip into those jammies and slippers, and plop yourself down in the Barca lounger, because we're ready to rumble. In a moment, Brad Steiger and Voices from Beyond. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. For five decades, Brad Steiger has been devoted to exploring and examining unusual, hidden, secret, or otherwise strange occurrences. He grew up in a home where ghostly phenomena was a common occurrence, and he's achieved a balanced attitude toward ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, aliens, that people say has served him well during his 50 years of paranormal research. His new book is called Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond and Parallel Dimensions, and it is really good. Brad Steiger, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, George. It's great to be back with you, and both Sherry and I appreciate the kind things you said about our new book.
Well, listen, I got to tell you right now, I've made a mistake in just having you. I got it, and I was kind of excited to have you on because I went through it, or I finished reading it this weekend. But in looking at it, I knew you had to have you on. But I'm going to have you back because there's not nearly enough time in this hour to cover all that we need to do. So I'll make that promise to you. But I want to start with this. I mentioned in the beginning of the program the 50-year anniversary of the swamp gas explanation. And sure enough, there's a section in this new book where you talk about that. 1966, the year of UFOs, this huge flap. Is that right about when you started on this stuff?
Exactly. Now, I started in the paranormal. And J. Allen Hynek, Sherry was the one who worked with him. In his later years, she worked in his office in Phoenix, and she was in charge of publicity and promotion. And she said, you know, he just never, never lived that down and got so tired of hearing, oh yeah, swamp gas, Hynek. Well, you know, he, as she will protest loudly, he never said that the UFO was swamp gas as it's come to be. He was pressed to give some answer by, let's just say, higher-ups, and said, you know, we've got to give some answer. People are going crazy. People are going wild about it. And so he did not have a chance to review it. He did not have a chance to go out and see the scene. He just was stuck with something to say, as we all have been from time to time. And he said, well, you know, there is such a thing as swamp gas that people see in forested regions. And he began to delineate what swamp gas was. And that was construed then that he was saying that's what the UFOs in Michigan were. And then that grew larger to Hynek declaring that's what UFOs were.
Well, but, you know, he more than made up for it, I think.
Oh,
you know,
he
on
more
balance.
Than made up for it. He was a wonderful man, and he did so much fine research. And we, of course, are really enthusiastic because, you know, he basically came to the same position that Sherry and I have, you know, that, okay, I mean, we believe, you know, that there may be life in outer space, of course, but what we're dealing with as we go on, and you know, that I've had to face so many things in my personal life that I see now, and I've had to re-examine in a different way, and we've done it in this book. And George, I love you for saying that this may be our best book, because I think it is. When I was a boy on the farm, used to go out baling hay in the sun, and we maybe had 500 bales to pick up, and my dad, every time as we're putting on the cart, when we put the last bale up, he would say, inevitably he would say, that's the one we've been looking for. And with this book, I think Sherry will agree with me, this is the one we've been looking for. This is the one. It's been called in some reviews a paranormal Bible. And without offending anybody, we're not saying it should substitute for your religious reading, but it is a Bible in the sense that I think we've covered just about every basic phenomena and interaction that the psyche can have with something beyond that we've just called the other.
Let me ask you this. We're going to get into the other in just a moment, but I don't want to leave the Hynek thing. I don't want to beat it to death, but I don't want to leave it without asking you this. From, you know, your wife, Sherry, spent Hynek's last years right. working closely with him.
Right.
Did you and she get a sense that maybe that swamp gas thing and all the furor it created was sort of the last nail in the coffin for him, that was it when he decided, I've had enough explaining using these bogus explanations on behalf of the Air Force. I'm going to look into this and find out what's going on.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly right. He had really been forced to toe the mark. And he wasn't the guy, you know, that he had his own thoughts. He has his own mind. He has his own research. He was a brilliant man. So for someone to say, in this case, you know, just tell him it's swamp gas and, you know, get rid of the journalist there. I think you've hit it exactly right, that that's when he decided, you know, there's something to this. There's something that indicates a new science. There's something that indicates a new way of apprehending the universe, of appraising what life really is, the true meaning of life. And that's what he went for. That's what he wanted to go for.
Well, there's a term that he used that I'm going to get to in a moment. But I just want to say, in talking about your book, Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond and Parallel Dimensions, at the end of the book, you write this. You say, we're not trying to convince anyone that any of this is true beyond all doubt, But it does seem to me, as the reader, that you're trying to make a case, a subtle one, that there is a connection, that something that ties all of these strange phenomena together, that maybe they're all an aspect of the same thing. You said a minute ago that you, in 1966, you were writing about the paranormal. I don't know if you knew that it would lead you into studying UFOs as well, or that you perceived a connection back then, but it sure seems like you perceive a connection now.
Totally. Let me just tell you quickly how I got into UFOs. I was completing the life of Rudolph Valentino for McFadden Bartell. That's the one that Ken Russell made into a movie, The Great Lover Valentino. And I had come upon some material and spoken to a number of people. My own aunt was on Broadway, and she knew Rudy, and she'd been at the funeral and so forth. So I was at my first New York cocktail party, and someone said, "Oh, you know, I've read this. You're going to be the next Harold Robbins. You're going to write the big blouse-ripping bestsellers." And I said, "I don't think so." And then my agent said, "You know, he likes this kooky stuff." Well, there were editors from several publishing houses there, and they said, "What do you mean?" Well, then it wasn't long before people were telling me about ghost experience, about haunting experience, whatever. And an editor said, "What about UFOs?" And I said, "Well, you know, I was 11 years old and 47. I really hope they're here, you know." And he said, "Well, why don't you write a book about UFOs?" And I had all the research. I'd been studying them. I hadn't written anything about UFOs, but I had all this research material. Now, here again, what became an embarrassment for the beloved J. Allen Hynek was a big break for me, because my book, Strangers from the Skies, came out the very week of the sighting in Michigan.
Oh.
When everyone was talking, like you say, that was the year of the saucers. And my first book on UFOs was on the paperback seller list in 2 weeks.
So, man, good timing.
Good timing. Timing is everything, as they say, you know, in this business.
So it seems to me, I can't remember the exact timing when John Keel got started making a connection of paranormal to UFOs.
Right.
It seems like he's a contemporary of yours, though. Maybe you were first, maybe he was first, but it seemed there are some parallels in the kind of work that you both ended up doing at the same time.
Absolutely. So Keel and I, the great Ivan T. Sanderson was a mentor of mine. And he was also a good friend of John's. And so John and I became good friends and started corresponding. So I set out in Strangers in Disguise to demonstrate they're here. They're here from outer space. Keel had written a book also saying, "They're here. They're here from outer space." And then after I began interviewing people, going out on the road, going out to speak at conferences, I thought, you know, this is sounding more and more like the paranormal. This is sounding more and more like I'm at a seance circle when people are telling me about what they were. And then I had this experience of talking to people who had seen entities from UFOs, and they both claimed to have seen it clearly, but they described entirely different entities. And I thought, you know, I said to John, I think, you know, I'm back in the paranormal. And he'd come to that conclusion, too, and he came out with a major book at that time. And in that sense, you know, who's first, you know? And there's no use arguing that, and there's no use debating it, because if you're really passionate about this field, you don't care who's first. You just care that the information gets out there, that it reaches people, that it stretches people's thoughts and minds and patterns of thinking. That's what's important if you really consider this, as Sherry and I do, as our mission.
You have a quote, a term that Hynek used, and I have read just about everything about him and every book that I think he ever wrote. A term that he used called meta-terrestrial, and I
right.
just don't remember ever seeing that before. And right off the front of your book, you start with that, and it sort of ties everything together. We're going to take a break here in a moment. When we come back, I want to get into what is meant by metaterrestrial, whether it's possible that extraterrestrials, interdimensionals, for all intents and purposes, are the same thing, that there's a link between aliens and demons and all these other strange phenomena that we at Coast tackle on a nightly basis. So our conversation with Brad Steiger continues in a moment. His book, Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond, packed with good stuff. And we go into the break with the Atlanta Rhythm Section, Champagne Jam. The bluesy Bad Boys of the British Invasion, that's The Animals, I'm Crying, from 1964. Eric Burdon and a version of the band still performing. I think they're coming to Las Vegas in May. I'm going to go see them. And about the time they started cranking out hits, Brad Steiger started cranking out books. As we mentioned, the new book, The Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond, explores possible connections between seemingly unrelated phenomena. It's a path that I've sort of been down myself. I've talked about it a couple of times on the show. Co-authored a book with Colm Kelleher called Hunt for the Skinwalker, in which we explored seeming connections between very strange, seemingly unrelated phenomena, poltergeists, UFOs, Bigfoot, crop circles, you name it, all in one place. And the Skinwalker legend, the Native American legend, has been getting a lot of attention lately because the author of the Harry Potter books has come out with something new, which explores skinwalkers in a way that's been upsetting to Native Americans. And it does fit in, sort of, because the skinwalker is kind of we used it as kind of a blanket or umbrella term for many different kinds of mysteries, something that's elusive, a trickster, a shapeshifter. That was our use of the term, and that's sort of what Brad Steiger and Sherry Steiger do in this new book, is tie a lot of things together. But the term they're using is metaterrestrial. We're going to get into what that means right after this on Coast to Coast. Brad Steiger, in the beginning of the book, you have use a quote from J. Allen Hynek, and I have never read it before. It's metaterrestrial. Tell us what that means and why you put it in the beginning of the book.
Well, because he's using a term that is really synonymous with the terms that we use in the book. In other words, you could say extra-dimensional, you could say interdimensional, you could say superphysical, you could say multidimensional. We're talking about the same kind of intelligence that we are concluding. As I said, we know it's a vast universe, and one model Sherry and I have is there's no dogma in paranormal research. You have to stay open. But we feel from what we have gained in our experiences of a lifetime is that the other dimensional, other realms that somehow interpenetrate our own little familiar hunk of space and time, that is what we've been talking about, regardless of what name we might give the phenomena. And what name we give the phenomena probably depends largely upon us, upon our background, upon our religious beliefs, upon our intellectual beliefs, upon our exposure to motion pictures, our exposure to legends and fables when we were growing up. We've been using the same descriptions, the same catalog of characterizations as far back as we can go in human perception of writing. When we first began putting things down on whatever we put them on, papyrus or stone walls, we were using the same terms and the same identity. Now, are we just all copycats? But no, in 47 we added a new dimension. They've come from outer space. And we had all kinds of new age prophets coming. And we have a chapter in this book about the religious implications and the UFO as, you know, of a new religious form, a new religion that people are adopting. The UFO has become a very strong element. I don't want to say substitute, because it's simply using the classical terms of spiritual expression with New Age or extraterrestrial or whatever you want to call it. The other, as we call it, with new identities, but it's the same. I meant to say new names, but it's the same identities. It's the same individuals, the same phenomena that's been interacting with us since we stood upright as a species, and quite likely before we stood up as a species.
You also call it the other, which I think is good, all-encompassing.
Yes, George, we've stopped, you know, saying, you know, we have them. I'm of Scandinavian background, and I have been plagued by what we call the Nissa, or the elves, because I saw one as a child, and that's the price I paid for it. Okay, little one, because I was 5 years old at that time, you have your proof, but you're going to live with it for the rest of your life. And sometimes it's been frightening. Now I've taken a sense of humor, because, okay, maybe I get frightened sometimes, but, you know, it's nothing that's harmed me, and it's in many ways strengthened me. In many ways, it's expanded my consciousness. It's expanded my horizon of what can be.
You know, I detected something in your voice when you first came on the program, when we first said hello. There's something, you used the term personal experiences, and I detected a little break in your voice that seemed emotional to me. And now I guess the question is, have you had multiple experiences, some of them not pleasant?
Yes. I have. We have a chapter on hauntings. Now, growing up in our old farmhouse was built where the old stagecoach stop used to be. And, you know, we heard people walking, we saw people talking. They're dressed in like 19th century clothing, because that's when the stagecoach stop was there. At night, very many times we'd hear horses and stagecoach coming down our lane. These are things that my sister and I, as we say, we've become almost sleep deprived individuals through our life, because of the travelers who maybe had missed the first ghostly stagecoach and are waiting for another that used to come to the room. And it's when these entities make eye contact with you that you get that little shiver inside. But most of the time it was just as if I were seeing a motion picture, as if I were seeing, of course we didn't have television when I was a lad, but as if you are seeing a scene, you can't interact with it, but you can see it. And that was my explanation when I first went out ghost researching and going to homes all over the country, investigating houses and helping people, sometimes doing exorcisms and so forth. My standard explanation was this was a psychic residue. This was a psychic residue that somehow impressed, just as film is impressed. This is impressed on the environment. And as I just said, you don't have to be afraid. You don't interact. But then in a house where three horrible murders had taken place, a force was trying to lock myself and the great spirit medium Irene Hughes, was trying to lock us into a closet while we were investigating a scene where a murder had taken place, and she was getting impressions, and she was just fabulous. And finally, when I went out, I said to my one of my crew, all right, the blankety blank thing, once it locked, once it closed, close it and lock it. And I said, that should fix the blank blank thing. I went upstairs. We all went upstairs, and within a few moments, we all heard the sound of that door being ripped off its hinges, and then the thud, thud, thud of something very large coming up the stairs, and then we were all lifted into the air. Now, that forced me to expand my theories of what hauntings might be and what ghosts might be. We have more personal experiences in this book than we've ever had, and some of them, in a sense, are emotional. Some of them are private, but we put them in a context where we're not embarrassed, and I don't think the reader will be embarrassed. But especially with the UFO, which is something, as I said in 1947 and in my first book, they're here, hooray, you know, the brothers from outer space. Well, now I see it very differently. And the thing, and I don't know how much time we have.
We got about 15 minutes. I'll tell you what. Let me ask you one other about some specific stuff.
I didn't mean to take over.
No. I told you we're going to have you come back, and I hope Sherry can come with you next time.
Great.
You had mentioned a couple of minutes ago that, you know, how we perceive these things, it really depends a lot on us. One man's angel is another man's demon. Somebody says it's an elf, and somebody else says it's an alien, and somebody says it's a poltergeist. And it does depend on us, but it also depends on what it is allows us to see, doesn't it? I mean, it chooses who is allowed to see it and what kind of a glimpse you get.
You've got two things operating there, of course, and you're absolutely right. But I think now that they have the ability to perceive that which would convince you, which would convince me or Sherry, that we are actually seeing something beyond our normal experience, something that will cause us to reflect and wonder and ponder, what did we see, why did we see it, and what are we supposed to do with this information?
You got a chapter in there written by a colleague of yours that deals with the jinn. And as I'm reading it, I was thinking about my own work about skinwalkers, this all-encompassing, strange, sometimes evil, always elusive trickster. Seems like the jinn fits that description as well. Tell us about that chapter of the book.
Yeah, that chapter, written by a very fine Muslim scholar, and I think the way, you know, the gentlemanly and professional way in which presented it, it's the most complete explanation of the jinn that we've ever encountered. And he says, I'm not taking advantage of the Steigers, you know, to push Islam. That's not my purpose. My purpose is to explain our interpretation of what the jinn have been throughout history, and it's astonishing, you know, how the jinn are much more complicated than we first think. Now, the skinwalker, which, you know, I've encountered when I lived in the Southwest, and have written a couple of books on Native American medicine and worked with a skinwalker, and I think, you know, you did a marvelous job in your Skinwalker Ranch book, and I think you've learned now that there are many other little or sometimes larger skinwalker areas around the United States.
Yes.
Where just a complete gamut of phenomena are running rampant, so to speak, like they've just taken over that particular area. So the jinn, I can't really do surface to it, you know, into his Mikhail's work by just trying to.
I think the main point being that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the main point being that it manifests itself, at least they believe it manifests itself in many strange ways, that in ways that you and I and our listeners would call straight up paranormal. It could look like aliens, it could look like demons, it manifests itself in many different ways, showing different things to different people. It explains a heck of a lot, and it ties a lot of stuff together.
It certainly does, and I guess you'll have to forgive me, George. I was thinking of the larger picture that Macaw gets into,
yeah,
of the civilization of the jinn, that they were existed and had a civilization on this planet before we were created, the Homo sapiens. And that gets really into something that I think in, you know, when we just read, just mentioning jinn, there's spooky little buggers, you know, the whole idea of the jinn is just so much more than that. And we just really grateful that we have this chapter. We have chapters and parts of chapters, people who have corresponded with us for years. I mean, scientists, nuclear physicists, Dr. Jack Hiller, I mentioned, he was, you know, he was with the Department of the Army, the research army researcher for 25 years. He was in the Pentagon, and he puts down a new theory of time because he read something in one of my books where I described my near-death experience when I was 11, and that so captured him that he thought, what is this where you go to an era, a dimension where time freezes, where time stands still? And he has written this brilliant theory of frozen time. And we have so many chapters, you know, that people with are sharing their unpublished research papers. And we feel so honored that they think so highly of the research we've done that they would share it for this book.
Well, it's good stuff. And the stories, I've never read these stories before, so it's kudos
you.
To you and Sherry. Let me ask you this question. As with the Skinwalker and the Jinn, I mean, this phenomena, you call it the Other or the Metaterrestrial. I mean, it is devious. It is it's misleading. It changes its look. It gives us a little glimpse of this, a little glimpse of that, but it's almost like a diversion. Look at the shiny lights in the sky. Look at the ghost under the bed. Look at the monster in the woods. It's manifests itself in different ways, almost seems to be toying with us, always one step ahead. I'm not sure that we can ever catch up.
I'm not sure either. But then, look how it all becomes that much more complex when some of these entities are nice to us. Some of them save us from death. Some of them save us from automobile accidents. Some of them interact and pull us out of bad situations, and we've all had those. Now, how do they enter in? And we have another scientist who has shared his experiences. He feels that he became an object of the attention of a particular kind of spiritual brotherhood that's been all the way back to the Watchers in the Old Testament. And he has been able, no, that isn't right. He has been the recipient of their kind attentions and has prospered. So we have, and then we have the alchemists who, we see them as, you know, the strange men making chemicals, but they were our early chemists. They were employing gnomes in the little, I always laugh at the gnomes in people's yards because gnomes aren't good critters. I mean, that's what the alchemists use to contact the dark side to get some of their information and to enslave the minds of people. So again, we have a whole section which I don't know, we just felt compelled to put in, where we really name all of these entities who have become cute and cuddly. I get a kick out of, you know, here again, my Scandinavian background, with the trolls from Another Damn Thing from Denmark. You know, trolls don't look like those bug-eyed little critters with red hair. I mean, trolls are you know, big as houses and monsters and so forth. So I don't know. I think, you know, some of the reviewers have commented they enjoyed that, where we went through kind of a who's who of nature spirits. At least it's something that, you know, fascinated us, and we hope that people will respond to it.
Well, I enjoyed the book very much, and Brad, we're out of time, but I promise you we'll have you come back this summer. and we'll dive deeper into this book. I hope you can bring Sherry Steiger along with you.
Oh, I hope so, yes.
Yeah, it's called Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond and Parallel Dimensions. I recommend it. And like I said, we just barely scratched the surface. There's so much more. It's a pretty wide, you cast a very wide net, and I think people would enjoy the book. So promise me you'll come back, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, that's a promise. And once again, we so appreciate your kind words and your attention. And as Chris Burrows, your producer, said, giving a preview, you know, giving a preview to people. I think that says it very well. And we appreciate your doing that so much, George.
All right. Brad Steiger, thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon again. And I hope people check out the book. Coming up, The Children of Roswell with Thomas Carey and Donald R. Schmidt. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Bob Seger takes us into the break.